apologist speeches for the people who aren't. So that's the way, like soul winning, like reaching out to these. The apologists are like the that's a very powerful tactic, because they're like, look, I was a cynic too, or like, I'm a scientist actually, and for 20 years I didn't believe, and then that makes them feel like, oh, so I don't believe either. So you and I have things in common, and then as they describe the process with which they started to believe, they're taking the listener on a journey, and if they find that the journey makes sense, then sometimes by the end of it, they now are, all the barriers they had to the Bible have just been sort of deconstructed by this guy's speech, because they're thinking, I thought that too, I thought that, and then they start looking at the Bible, you know. So the apologist tactic has a, you know, a great purpose, and Seth Rogen's approach and tact for winning over fans to the movie, he made a remake of The Room. He comes out saying, yes, The Room's a terrible film, and for many reasons, but you have to wonder, a film that I've watched, there are good films that I haven't watched near as many times as this bad film. And there are bad films I would never want to watch again, but I have watched The Room more times, I have watched The Room more times than my favorite good films. So there's something there that makes you want to keep coming back, especially when they say, and that's Tommy's heart, you know, he put his story out there, and maybe, you know, there was some issues with the way he filmed it, and maybe his dialogue and just little technical things, but it still reaches people in some way. And but anyway, the reason I brought it up is because when you were talking about the talent Mr. Ripley, I didn't know, for the most part, because this was like internet, YouTube exploration, one thing led to another, and now it's like, oh, Tommy Wiseau is in this clip, who is this guy, right? And so eventually it came up that what he wrote this, what inspired his writing this was, when he was in the film school, he and Greg went to see The Talented Mr. Ripley, and then when they came back, and it was like the first film they had seen together. So it's like taking somebody who's got second language English, who's happy to be in America, made a lot of money, and decides, because he's got $6 million or something from real estate, like, I'm going to make a movie. He's in his 40s. He knows he still looks the best he's going to look, probably. And he has a little bit of scarring from maybe the car accident. And he really just wants to make this film while he's alive and stuff. And he's got this new attitude after the accident where he's just not afraid of anything, you know. You should just do what you believe in, you know, Greg. We're gonna make this film. We're gonna make it, yeah. After this scene, Talented Mr. Ripley's like, I think I can make a movie that will shock everybody for weeks. So had he not watched The Talented Mr. Ripley, a movie that is kind of set up to shock you at the end, right? The Room probably wouldn't have been what it was, because that's exactly how The Room is set up. The Room is like somebody who just took The Talented Mr. Ripley and made, well, what if I just include, you know, my world, like my family members and my experiences, and make my own The Talented Mr. Tom Wiseau, and then just call it The Room or something, and then say, you know, a talent that, and people love to make, and talk about it helps. Talking about it helps him because it's free PR, and that's why he's got a cult following. But mostly the talk is like people just, I don't know how to say it. They're laughing and they're so amused that it actually brings them joy to talk about all the little things that he did to promote his thing that are so juvenile. And like, you know, like, here's an example. He spent like $100,000 to put a billboard up that says The Room on it, right? It's not like we're making fun of him. It's just true. He did this. And like, in a way, they're like envious. Like, well, if I had that much money, maybe I'd do that too. Like, you spend $100,000 to put up a Stevens Produce sign and with a phone number on there. And then the phone number is like, you know, The Room, and there's a phone number. And so there were so many famous celebrities before this movie got famous, who saw that sign, and they wonder, like, what is The Room? Is this a cult or something? Because there's a picture of Tommy, and he was fascinated with he was fascinated with the actor James Dean, his look. So he's trying to pull a James Dean look, but, you know, he's not James Dean, and his hair is long and everything. So he's just, and so nobody knows the reference. They're just seeing this guy who's got this look, like almost like Steven making a weird face, right? But it's a close-up, and it's in black and white on a giant billboard in an expensive place. And so many people are driving and seeing The Room, and there's his phone number. And there was, you know, it just, it comes up a lot. Like, I remember seeing that sign. I thought it was a cult. I didn't even know what that was. But some people, they would say, you know, we call the number, and you know what the number is, what it leads to? Tommy's cell phone. Like, who would put their cell phone on? So you call the number. Hello. And then he would pick it up. oh, hi, and he has an accent because he's like Polish, and he claims that he was from Louisiana. From the, you know, people love to do his impersonation. I haven't practiced it, but he's like, oh, hi, this is Tommy. Yeah, come tonight, see the room. Yeah, all right. You know, you're just talking to him. Are you going to see the room? Oh, good. Yeah, it's showing in the theater. And so when the film came out, he, after spending the amount of money he spent on it, and the other thing was he bought two sets. He bought the equipment. Usually you rent it, right? They had HD and they had another format, right? And there was no way to mix the two formats. But he thought, because it's clear, and I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't like just mimic the attitude that most people had toward him, which is that this is so farcical. Because he would say after the fact, no, this is cutting edge. See, nobody, they didn't have 3D then. And so they had HD and they had this other format. And people joke, you know, oh, why'd you record it twice? It cost you twice the amount of money and that makes no sense. But at the time, they didn't have 3D. And so they're still talking about making 3D. Now it makes him sound like he's smart and he knows what he's doing. But there's still no 3D movie, and we don't know if he's ever going to make it to a 3D movie. But he was. But he made a point. He was saying, well, because one records at this resolution, but the other one has a different something, and so he just captured them both. Well, he had that money. He knew he was going to make this one film. This is the thing of his life, so he's like, I'm doing the comics. Like, I don't need to spend this much money to try to do what I'm doing, but I feel like this is the one time I'm going to do this, and if I can just sell it back, then it almost makes no difference, other than it maybe looks eccentric in the moment. And so he opened it to a $1,000, $1,113 or something like this. That's not the exact figure. And I would never post on YouTube because be like, you don't know what you're talking about. But it was like something like that, a small figure, you know, like no more than $1,000 opening. I mean, you know, you hear Star Wars opens, if it doesn't make $1.2 billion, it's, or whatever the number, it's at one point, if it's off a point of a billion, then it's now a big failure, right? So you don't spend $6 million on a film and then make $1,000 back, right? But the positive side of the story is, good morning. The positive side of the story is, the film became a cult success, and he kept putting it in his theater, and then it started opening, and it's featured now every year. It's like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, that kind of thing, where the cult movie people go to it, and they do stuff like they throw spoons in the air when some of the silly you know, the notorious scenes happen, you know, the scenes where it's like the dialogue is so plotting and direct that you get the feeling that, you know, like, it just, I guess it's funny to people, yeah, right? Yeah.
That's how they do.
Yeah, and he got all the money back after so many years. Yeah, but anyway, I was just saying, yeah, you know. Good.
Put this back on the shelf. Coyote. I don't know if you know these people, but I
know Sinise. He's the actor that was in
Forrest Gump.
In Apollo, yeah.
Peter Coyote has read different things. Yeah.
I've never heard of the Coyote guy. Like a cool name, though.
He's old. I think he would be older than Sinise.
Really?
Don't recall.
See, he didn't say at this point must be old, right? Because he looked like he was 40 in the film.
Yeah, I suspect
like his late 40s.
Like, how would his age compare to Tom Hanks? They could be close to the same age, I guess.
Sinise had a little spurt of his career at that time. He started appearing in lots of films.
I haven't seen
him after, I guess, that little 5 to 10 year period. It seems like that's a lot with most actors. They get their little period, you know, and then that's it. Like 10 years, maybe.
Well, definitely. It's, of course, some just go on and on. But then it's a matter...
Yeah, like Tom Cruise.
It's a matter of finding a role that fits an older person. And or, like, my goodness, Sylvester Stallone still doing the same stuff.
Rambo,
Expendables. He's an old person, I guess. He's still very fit as far as moving and all that stuff.
When I last saw, you know, it was when maybe 10 years ago, Expendables, and he was showing clips of his workout. And he's got trainers,
oh, sure,
diets.
And then he doesn't look like that often.
Isn't there like a fairly recent Rocky? Another Rocky.
That's true. There's a whole new series, right?
Yeah, Rocky.
They made one that's called Rocky? Like a new one called Rocky? Because they made a series that was a reboot of Rocky that I keep hearing about on Kevin Smith called Creed.
I think it's just within... Okay, maybe that's it, a different name. But I was saying it's within the last 2 or 3 years, I think. He's older than me. Yeah. He's older than me. I'm thinking just a couple
of
years.
He's a special character. And he's not that tall, you know?
Yeah.
But he's still able to come across like, you know,
yeah,
this, you know, macho guy, which is cool.
Mm-hmm. But I think his appeal is that he's very easy to relate to because he presents himself...
Yeah, he does, and I don't think he comes across as a snob. Or, I mean, I know in the movies he's a macho guy, but I don't know how to say it. It doesn't seem like he's super proud of his. I mean,
his machismo might be humble. It's more not. It's like he's humble, but he still stands up for himself as opposed to he has to push everybody around all the time or something. He's not like he seems like a nicer guy. Like in everything I've seen, he's always shown helping people. Going the extra mile.
Which is another, I was going to say with Burt Reynolds, the movie persona of Burt Reynolds, I think, is actually kind of, again, I'm a macho, but it seems like actually some of the stuff I read in the, like, since he's dead about how he would always supporting young actors and very supportive.
Because the main thrust of his
and
career.
Apparently a very easy person to interview.
He did a lot of teaching of young theater people.
Who are you talking to now about
Burt Reynolds? I saw in the newspaper when he died.
Yeah,
they were saying
that
there's this whole thing where he was teaching so many people, mentoring people, and there's famous people who were saying, "Oh, Burt Reynolds taught me so much," and like that was the bigger span of his life is helping other people than his actual career as an actor himself.
But then when you think of his career,
I
don't think we think of him as a super great. I mean, he definitely, for a period of time, he had top-selling movies. I mean, there was a short, I don't know, it was 8 years, so many, for a short time, the top box office movies were his for a short period of time.
See, remember he had that B.L. Stryker? That's when I was...
Well, that was TV, right?
Yeah, I remember it because it was being filmed in West Palm or something. I didn't watch it. I mean, I was at an age that I guess it wasn't...
I don't think I did either, but...
But we had the BR feed store we used to ride our bike to. Yeah. So we always felt like, oh, Burt Reynolds is our neighbor or something. You know, we'd see his mansion there. I never saw him.
I would often kind of kid people when they say, when they ask, I live in Jupiter Farms, you know, home of Burt Reynolds, but I've never seen him.
You know, I can show you what you sound like so you get an idea. I don't know how much that's fun for you. I always love stuff like that.
I don't necessarily need to hear that.
Okay, because this speaker system isn't the best anyway. But later, if I mix it, when it's on that speaker system, you'll get an idea of how good this mic actually records.
Yeah, let me maybe check on mine.
Yeah. Get the feeling she's going to...
Laurence Olivier. Of course, he was a stage actor, I guess... First, you know of him?
Yes.
Sir Laurence Olivier. Yeah, a lot of these really good ones end up getting knighted by the Queen or whatever. So, Sir Laurence Olivier.
I just don't remember what he looks like. Because I keep thinking of Peter O'Toole.
Okay. Yeah, Laurence Olivier, like, was not a huge man. And, Peter O'Toole definitely had a distinctive look. And he was British, right?
Yeah.
Peter O'Toole.
He lived a long time. I don't even know if he's dead yet. I assume he must be.
Thank you.
Because he'd have to be in his 90s now, right?
Yeah.
He was in his 80s when he was in Troy, right? With Brad Pitt.
All I remember is Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. Oh, that's why. That's Lawrence Olivier and
Lawrence of Arabia. There's definitely... But maybe that's it. Some of these people, they start on stage at theater.
Well, Mark Hamill, who played Star Wars, ended up spending time in the theater.
Okay, and then some of them have a movie career, and then they go back, because that's maybe their first love is the stage, so they eventually go back to the stage, yeah.
Somebody just recently that's
back at the stage again, yeah.
The guy who was in Jim Carrey's film Dumb and Dumber, because, I mean, all of Stephen Coleman Schuler's kids seem to know that movie.
Okay.
Or Stephanie Taylor loves that movie, and she shows her kids... on the iPhone scenes from it regularly.
Okay.
Like, so they all know that guy. Played Atticus Finch on Broadway in the last in the Trump era. It was like his, like, you know, Robert De Niro was saying something about, without trying to get political, he was saying that he feels it's a civic duty to play the role of that.
The most recent Godfather, the mafia movie, or because they all came back together, the Niro and De Niro and
oh, you're talking about The Irishman?
Yeah, yeah, they all came back to.
Oh, that was his big movie. Film. Yeah, he said he got shaped for that.
Who's the other guy? De Niro and
oh, was it De Niro, Joe Pesci, and all those guys?
Yeah, yeah, Pesci and the third one.
Ray Liotta or
well, I think yeah, it was Ray was in there too, and then the fourth guy then.
Robert De Niro, Joe
Robert no.
Oh yeah, Robert yeah, yeah. Bob Lowe, right? No. Who's the guy? That's
the other guy. Same era as De Niro. I just can't think.
Pacino, right?
Yeah, Al Pacino. And Al Pacino, they said he is definitely intense, and it has to be just right. I think, right?
Do you like his films? Do you like him?
I don't know if I watch that. I don't even. I don't think I've ever watched The Godfather, even actually.
Oh really? I watched it because it was on a list of the movies that, like that, the Jupiter Library has a section of like, famous. I don't know. Somehow this is supposed to be educational. Like if you don't want, like if you want to know American history, you should watch these films. So like Godfather, something like that. So I was just watching everything on the list, and but you know Al Pacino was in a film called A Dog Day Afternoon.
Serpico, right?
He was in Serpico too, and that was probably his prime, right? Because he was younger and stuff. He would be running between places, and he was probably at his highest pitch of this drama. But like you know what people think of him as is the caricature. Well, I mean, younger people might, the younger generations, as the caricature he kind of you know portrayed when he was older, where he would put a lot of the intensity not into. Physically running around, but changing the volume of his voice. Mm-hmm. Have you seen an impersonation by Bill Hader of Al Pacino?
Probably not.
It's so spot on that you like.
That's amazing, these impressions, how spot on they can be sometimes.
He's like, he's doing Al Pacino, and the chief characteristic.
It's not on the voice, it's the movements, the facial, all that stuff.
And it's so fascinating.
Amazing how
good
they are.
I would love to watch again, I should. the chief characteristic of the impersonation of Al Pacino is the decibel change. That is just so abrupt. It's like, it's like, so something. Yeah, and then there's something. And it's like, it just goes from like decibel level 2 to 8 to like 10, you know, 2 above 10 or something. And that's just normal. And he's just talking in that loud voice and then drops back down. It's like, yeah, that's right. That's how Al Pacino did things. Because who talks like that? It's like
I guess in a way, the person there has to practice it even. Has to actually practice it more than the original actor to get it right, I guess.
Yeah, it looks like magic, unless you're the guy who lives with him and you had to hear it 95 times. That's what Emmanuel, can't remember his name right now, who plays guitar after Chet Atkins in the style Chet, he was inspired by him, but he can't read music, and he's Australian, so he heard it on the radio, and his dad died early, and they used to, whole family, play as musicians, maybe like Devon Trapp, and then in his like 60s, he's still doing that, right? And he's playing it all from by ear and by memory, right? And the thing is, he's a wizard at speed. But I think, I guess, you know, there's obviously some cap on the career. Even as he slowed down in the 50s, he tried to keep up, but then he ended up with heart problems. So I think he's kind of chilled out now. You don't hear too much from him. But Tommy Emmanuel would, he would play Chet Atkins and then give credit to Chet Atkins. And trying to think when I brought this up. Oh, he was saying the practicing. He's saying, you know, when people say, do you get arthritis, or I play guitar, but I have joint pain, I don't know what that means. I guess that's good. I should be glad. Because I play, because they ask, like, how long should I practice, Tommy? I don't want to practice too much. And he's like, I play all the time, every day. And he's just trying to, you know, be honest, like, this is my world. Like, this is my life, my whole thing is guitar. And it's kind of, to me, it was fun to hear, because they're like, and people were upholding him because of, like, seeing this guy who's, like you, when you were at an age where your hair is white, but you're doing the work that would make most people 10 years, 20 years younger than you feel tired. You know, they're just inspired by it, right? So Tommy, so at some point when he got his hair white and he's still able to play fast, he went to like not this esoteric type of music, but inspiration, like Tommy Emmanuel, inspiring. And then you just had people watching, like, I can tell that's a 60-year-old dude.
It's still amazing,
or a 50-year-old dude.
That, like Charlie Daniels with the fiddle, he's, I think maybe, did he just turn 80? He's still performing.
Really?
Still performing.
I should check that out. He's the one the devil went down to Georgia. Stephen loves that song.
Yeah, yeah. And he's even, you know, I'd say he's overweight, and maybe, I don't know how healthy he is, but some of these, well, just like singers, you know, granted, I guess maybe, I don't know, what do you lose? As you get older, do you lose range? You lose wind power? I guess in theory, you should definitely lose some wind power, I guess, maybe. But
that's,
you know,
a good,
but in church choirs, these, you know, some, I guess that's one thing that you don't, I mean, J.D. Sumner, he didn't live too terribly long. He was in his 70s, I think, when he died, but he had his deep bass voice all to the very end. I mean,
yeah,
maybe not as
yeah.
deep, you know, maybe he lost a little bit, but he of course, he, I don't think he forgot the words of the song, so he could always just still sing.
Well,
that's one thing you, I guess you don't lose so quickly.
Yeah. It seems like Mr. Rogers started to not be able to really carry his tunes or even try as hard as you would expect from his earlier videos when he was in the period after his late 40s. I just can't, you know, I don't know all the numbers,
yeah.
but it was like in his late 40s, he was getting a lot of airplay and honor from talk shows of people who grew up with him. So this would be like, you know, he was 38 when he was on his first Mr. Rogers television
know,
show.
Yeah,
prior to that,
yeah.
he had been a floor manager for
yeah,
NBC,
he
and he was talked
yeah.
into being on the Mr. Rogers show or something, Mr. Rogers in Canada. And then at some point later, he bought the whole thing, and then he became the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood. When he was getting all this fame, like worldwide fame, where everybody recognized Mr. Rogers, like Sesame Street, like, you
mm-hmm.
know, Big Bird, R2-D2, Mr. Rogers. He was, you know, probably 48, and he already had a bunch of kids and everything with his wife, Joan, who was a concert pianist, right? And all these, he had a lot of kids. I think he had more than four. Right? It seemed like they were all boys. And he ended up with stomach cancer near the end. And you know what, he died in 2000-something, maybe? And he didn't tell anybody about it because he didn't want people worrying about it. But it was the period of time when I guess he was getting the treatment that he was the least, you know, the least active. But there was a period between, I guess, a little bit after the 48 where he was still singing his songs, and then we just didn't know what was going on, and then it was clearly ill, and then he didn't last much longer. And there was a period where he would kind of just talk his songs, like, you know, like,
yeah.
everybody's
but
fancy,
but
everybody,
was,
and that's just talking, it's not really,
was,
everybody's
no
fancy, there's a difference between singing, and he just didn't have that air
yeah.
power, but he kept swimming, that's the thing. So maybe when it came to the choice, like, I have this many units of energy, I'm going to swim.